I'm Joanna Shanks.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke. So, Emma, do you have any chat for us this week?
No, I do not have any chat. We were actually just saying that we've both given ourselves a little bit of a break from true crime over the festive periods. We just took a bit of time off, relaxed and watched non-gory, non-gruesome things on the television and listened to nice, cheery, Christmassy things. So we did have a little chat beforehand and we decided to do two stories, two separate cases in today's episodes. We normally have some recommendations for you or a little bit of extra chat, but we don't have that this time, so you get some bonus content. All right, Joanna, what is your case for today?
Okay, so Emma, I wanted to tell you about the case of James Jimmy Boyle. Have you heard of him before?
No, I have not.
Okay, fantastic. So this is quite an interesting case. Initially, when I started looking into it, I didn't find a huge amount of information, and then I just ended up in a wealth of research and came across quite a bit of information. So I'm just going to jump right in. So Jimmy Boyle was one of four children who grew up in the Gorbals in Glasgow. He was born in 1944, and he was apparently the son of a safe breaker, and life as he knew it was full of crime. His dad died when he was very young, and he was raised by a single mother. As a youngster, he spent time in Borstals and approved schools, which hardened him. As a young man, he ran shebeens. Have you heard that term before, Emma, shebeens?
No, I haven't heard that. What's that?
I hadn't either. So apparently they were premises that were selling alcohol illegally.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I hadn't heard that term either. Yeah, so shebeens and money lending rackets as well. He had a reputation as an incredibly violent person and was dubbed as a Glasgow gangster. In 1967, at age 23, he was convicted of killing a fellow gangster by the name of William Babs Rooney after going to collect a debt that Babs Rooney owed. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison, and whilst in Barnaluddy prison, he began sculpting. He agreed to sculpt a piece in commemoration of the poet William McGonagall, however it was never completed. He also met his first wife while in prison, who was a psychotherapist, and wrote his first autobiography, A Sense of Freedom, in 1977, which was made into a film of the same name. He also wrote a play called The Hard Man in the same year. After being released from prison in October 1981, he set up a foundation offering art therapy to former convicts and drug addicts. The foundation received backing from some famous people such as Sir Sean Connery and Sir Billy Connolly, however, collapsed after a few years of existence. He also released a further autobiography called Pain of Confinement in 1984. In 1994, his oldest son James was stabbed to death in Glasgow, aged 26. His son was a heroin addict, and Jimmy Boyle had apparently anticipated his death, however, assuming it would be as the result of an overdose. He released a novel called Hero of the Underworld in 1999 and married the actor Kate Fenwick in 2007. She is known for starring in British programmes such as The Bill, Casualty and Silent Witness. Others have disputed his claims to his life of crime being about survival, stating that many others who grew up in the same or similar areas from a background of poverty never chose this path in life. Jimmy Boyle has always professed his innocence for the murder of William Babs Rooney, but admitted to slashing him across the chest. He eventually confirmed Rooney was murdered by his co-accused, but took the rap for the crime due to the unwritten no-grassing rule amongst those whose circles he mixed in. Just for anyone who isn't familiar with this term outside of the UK, a grass is basically somebody who tells on someone else, who basically...
Yeah, who rats them in.
Who rats them out, yeah, who offers them up, basically. So,
but you would use it, it's not just like in criminal terms, you'd use it with even your mum and dad, that kind of thing. Like if your sibling told on you, yeah, like, oh, you're a wee grass.
Yeah,
like that
kind of thing. Yeah, I'm not grass. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So so there's a no grassing rule amongst those whose circles he mixed in, which I assume is the same kind of the world over. You don't rat out your sort of fellow
counterparts, that your partners in crime, so to speak.
I was going to say colleagues, but that's probably not the right terminology. So following having committed violent crimes and prior to his imprisonment, he would flee to London, where he was under the protection of the Crays. After being released from prison, he lived in a 12-bedroom house in Inverleith, which is in the Newtown area of Edinburgh.
How big?
12 bedrooms.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. With his wife, who's a psychotherapist.
I thought crime didn't pay.
Yeah.
It's the novels that paid, probably.
And his sculptures, because of his art.
Yeah.
So he actually had really good success with his sculptures. I don't think so much in Edinburgh, though. I think he didn't really agree with the kind of snobby outlook that people in Edinburgh had, but around the world, and he was involved in overseeing installations and things like that. So a successful artist, definitely, and obviously has written novels as well. Both of his younger children attended private school, and he became integrated in a higher class of society. He spent much time in the south of France and Morocco, and eventually left Edinburgh to live on the French Riviera permanently, and he's now 76 years old. So that is the case of James Jimmy Boyle. He was in the special unit at Barlinnie Prison in Glasgow, and some of the excerpts from his book, in which he talks about the things that he did in prison and what happened to him, is absolutely awful, frankly. Beatings from prison officers, and it just sounds absolutely horrendous. He was in solitary confinement for a long time, and I think he was sort of borderline insane. You know, he was in a really, really bad place, and I think being introduced to sculpting kind of saved him. You know, which I assume is why he sort of then went on to establish this foundation to do the same for former convicts and drug addicts. And it seems that it was a bit of an outlet for him to express his emotions and stuff. Apparently sculptures are, you know, figures sort of crying out pain and, you know, and terror and all these sort of things. So
yeah. They're quite visceral. They're quite emotive.
Yeah. He basically said in an interview, like, you know, nothing about what I do is like, it is to reflect the greater good. You know, it's all about pain and, you know, just that sort of internal torture and all that kind of stuff. So
wow,
seems to have sort of saved him and turned his life around, which is really quite impressive.
It's like the plot for a film. You couldn't make that up. I mean, how can one person have all these experiences in their life, you know?
Absolutely.
It just amazes me when there's humans out there like that, and then you've got other people who kind of bumble along, you know, la-di-da, have a nice wee life, and you know, it's all great. But I always think with people that, and clearly wrongly, I've thought this in the past, if he's been used as an example, I've always thought that once you fall into, you know, criminal underworld and get yourself wrapped up in these kind of things, you're not really going to be able to extricate yourself from it, and you're not really going to be able to live a normal life. But I think that's maybe what the media has led me to believe.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't really say that my experience of it is anything other than a complete layman's perspective. But yeah, my understanding is if you're involved in that kind of life, that's what you're surrounded by, that's what you know, that's the people you're surrounded by. Even if you do serve time and you're re-released into that sort of community, that environment, I think it must be incredibly hard to break out of that. Unless you're given a fresh start, a clean slate, opportunities, chances to show that you're reformed, you know, you're given a bit of trust, you know, and not everybody will want to reform their life. You know, there will be people that just want to go back to what they know. But, you know, for anybody that did want to, I think it must be a huge, huge task. You know, and obviously, I know we've talked previously about people that say, oh, you know, I can't believe prisoners are released early to be integrated into society. But especially after having been confined in prison for a long, long time, you have to reintroduce these people to community, like into the community gradually. You can't just sort of go, there you go, good luck, all the best.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. You know, if you actually want to reform, and that's exactly what prison should be. It should be about reform. It shouldn't just be lock somebody up and throw away the key. I know that there are hopeless cases that, you know, you could probably never hope to reform, but the overarching goal is to reform the people that haven't had the same opportunities as others.
Like you said, I think it depends on the individual, and if there is something drastically wrong with them, you know, psychologically or as a result of other factors, that, you know, they're going to go back out and commit more, you know, murders, then it's a little bit different. But yeah, I think with something like that, and he claims that he didn't even do it in the first place, not that that's entirely relevant, but, you know, I think especially in criminal networks and gangs, it's not that they're all gangs of predators who've all banded together just to do this for fun. Do you know what I mean? It is part of their...
It's survival.
Yeah, but it's survival, yeah. And I don't... I'm sure there will be some of them that take pleasure in it, but I wouldn't say, oh, I'm going to become a gangster because I really enjoy shooting someone in the head. I think it's...
It's more opportunity. It's like, you know, well, if your prospects are, well, I have no skills, I have no opportunity to go into higher education, university is basically not an option to me, so I either, if I have no skills, then, you know, my options are
minimum wage
work in a minimum wage job, you know, work my fingers to the bone for very little, and basically live probably a bit of a meager life and never really get out of, you know, the areas where, you know, that you've been brought up probably, or go into a life of crime, you know, potentially earn a lot of money, whether that be, you know, doing a money lending racket or dealing drugs or whatever you do, pimping out, you know, sex workers, whatever, you know, get a bit of money in the bank, be able to buy a nice car, a nice house, you know, I get it. Yeah. Like if your opportunities are limited, then...
And it never starts off at the top end. Obviously, it's always a little bit here or there. It's like, oh, do you want to make 50 quid by selling these drugs for me? Yeah, okay, but just this once, you know, and that's the kind of stories that you hear of people
absolutely
getting sucked into it piece by piece.
It comes into part of that argument that I make, you know, that it just frustrates me when you get people in society that all get annoyed about things like social housing. And for example, you know, I live in a new development, brand new development, and you'll get people that say, oh, you know, can't believe these people just get placed here. You know, however, if you were to take all of the people that are from like poor socioeconomic backgrounds and put them all into one area, that's why you get areas where it's just a complete vicious circle of crime and poor education, poor opportunities.
It's also incredibly elitist to just say, not our problem, chuck them over there.
Absolutely. Whereas if
it's, you're not, no one's that far away from that.
Exactly.
You know, no one's that far away from it. They're an illness away, or you know, a job fall through away. They're a bankruptcy away from
absolutely
being in a place that they never thought that they would be either.
I think there's, I think I've heard chat that it's something like most people are only like two paydays away from being in like a terrible situation, because the problem is that, not that I want to get to like a massive, you know, discussion on this, but the situation in Britain is that debt is the norm. You live beyond your means, you take on a lot of debt, and actually who lives and can say that they're debt free other than, say, their mortgage? Like, probably very few people. Everybody's overcommitted. So if you find yourself in a situation where you don't have a job, well, you probably don't have any savings because you're too busy paying off your debt. So you don't have that the savings to buffer you.
I'm strangely impressed and kind of proud of him. I know that sounds super condescending. I guess maybe what I mean is I'm inspired by him.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because, I mean, he was pegged as Scotland's most violent man. And in prison, I believe that he was charged with the attempted murder of 6 prison officers. He spent time in solitary confinement within a cage, within a cell. And apparently he sort of covered himself in excrement in order to avoid a beating from the prison officers that he knew was inevitable. So he resorted to things like that. It just sounds like, how do you escape that? If you're in there for a 15-year sentence, what hope or chance is there of reform if people have taken, oh, look, here's the hard man, here's the most violent man in Scotland, we'll break him. Do you know what I mean? If you're dealing with those kind of people and that's what you're up against.
Redemption.
Exactly. What hope have you got? that sort of slim little sliver of sunlight, you know, to kind of opportunity to grasp something, which, you know, he said that basically it was discovering an unknown talent, but maybe it was just the fact that he needed an outlet for everything that was going on in his mind in order to be able to express himself. And he was able to do that through sculpture. And ultimately, you know, that's what led to his turnaround in life. But it doesn't seem like he's become this guy who likes to think he's some sort of elitist. You know, he's very much still seems to be, this is who I am, this is my past. He sort of seems to own who he is. And he admits that his former life, he admits that he was involved in, that he was very violent, that he was a very violent person, and he was involved in attacking William Babs Rooney, but that he wasn't responsible for his murder.
What were the name of the books again, just if anyone wants to pick them up?
The first autobiography he wrote when he was in prison, and that is called A Sense of Freedom.
And what's it? What's his pen name, is it?
It's just Jimmy Boyle.
Okay.
Yeah. So he wrote A Sense of Freedom in 1977. After being released from prison, I think it was maybe 3 years after, he wrote a further autobiography called Pain of Confinement. Then he released a novel, a fictional novel called Hero of the Underworld in 1999.
I always think if you have to write two autobiographies, you've had like too much life experience.
Yeah, exactly. In one. Exactly. And I believe he was also writing another book. I couldn't seem to find it, so I don't know if it was released, but he was writing another book, which was supposed to be, I think it was like a dark comedy about a theft of the Mona Lisa, but I couldn't see details that had been released, so that might still be in the works. So those are the books that he has out at the moment, if anybody wants to go and have a read of them.
Amazing. That's super interesting, and I'll need to do a lot more research into him. And you said that was recommended to you by one of our...
No, assets. This one no. wasn't actually. I came across this one a while ago and I started doing a little bit of research on it. At the time, I was kind of struggling to find a lot of detail about his life or actually about the murder. I think that's why I gave up on it. I found a bit about him and him turning his life around and his sculptures and things, but I couldn't find much about the victim, which I think is why I shelved it. And I thought, you know what, I can't... And still, I can't seem to find much information at all about the victim, unfortunately, William Babs Rooney. So I decided to pick it up again, but just focus on the fact that this was somebody who was convicted of his murder, but turned his life around following a horrendous sort of life and stint in prison.
Definitely quite an interesting person for anyone who is interested in true crime in Scotland in particular, and probably the system in general. So yeah, it'd be quite good for people to look into him. So yeah, I like that one. Really good.
Interesting guy. He's the type of guy that, you know how there's just certain people how you would love to just meet them for a pint and just pick their brains and hear what they've got to say and stories that they've got to tell. I find certain people really fascinating. You know, I just love to sit down and have a conversation with them. And he is one of those people. He's probably one of the people that I would like to invite if I ever had if you could invite specific people to a dinner party, who would you invite?
You should reach out to him and see if he wants to come on the podcast then.
I might do, because as we know, our listeners don't yet, this is a nice little surprise. The next 2 weeks, we have some exciting bonus content with a guest who spoke with us recently. So next episode and the episode afterwards is quite exciting. We're releasing two bonus episodes, which were thoroughly enjoyable to record and listen to. And I'm sure that our listeners will be just as interested to listen to them as we were.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't wait for them to come out.
Do you often find that you need a distraction from everyday life?
Do you like true crime, conspiracy theories, paranormal stories, and other weird, dark tales?
Well, tune in and turn up Weird Distractions Podcast, where we, your hosts, Christy
and Alex,
bring you a weird distraction to help you get through the work week.
Every Sunday morning, you can find our show on Apple Podcasts, Anchor, Spotify, Good Pods, and more.
So grab a snack, get comfy,
and make sure to lock those doors.
Need a distraction? We got you.
So yeah, Emma, what is your case today?
Well, I'm afraid I'm now going to horribly depress everyone.
Oh no, what is it?
I'm terribly sorry. So this is a case, it's not technically listed as a crime, but I think that it's fitting and it's possible that there's a crime involved. It's regarding a baby boy who was found dead in 2001 in Edinburgh. So on the 11th of March 2001, the body of a newly born baby boy was found beside a footpath between Harewood Drive and Harewood Road in the Craigmillar area of Edinburgh by a local man walking his dog.
I think I remember this case.
Yes, horrible. But still needs information and still needs put out there. So the baby was no more than a few days old and he was lying on his side with his fists drawn up to his chest and he had dark hair. The dog walker, who was called Billy Franks, who was actually, I believe, a retired dog handler in one of the arms of the military, so, you know, fairly seasoned individual, he saw the baby and he was completely traumatised and horrified because the little boy was found naked and he'd been burned. There was various reports in sources that have indicated that the body might also have been injured or mutilated in some way. The dog walker, Billy Franks, he went and reported it to a neighbour. He pretty much ran straight away to the closest phone they could get. Police came and it looked as though it was 2 or 3 days since the death of the wee boy that he was found. They took the body for a post-mortem, which failed to establish a cause of death, but it did show that he was born alive. He had been at least alive for 24 hours, possibly as long as 3 days, and that he had been bathed, he'd been fed, and he'd been dressed in the time preceding his death. Nearby, there lay a Disney-themed baby grow, which is a romper for anyone outside of the UK, and a can of petrol, empty.
Jesus.
Yeah. The Disney-themed baby grow, it wasn't like a licensed one, so it wouldn't have been sold by Disney themselves or, you know, like a department store or anything like that. It was made by like a small operation, not handmade, but, you know, something that might have been sold at a market stall, that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And the child was also wrapped up in a blanket with a satin trim, which had holes in it. This is a bit of a weird point next, and it may not have anything to do with the baby's death at all, but there was a label found near where he was found, and it was thought to have come from a China doll from the Leonardo collection. It was basically an authenticity certificate, and these were fancy China dolls. The Leonardo collection manufactured about 100 different types of doll, but they all had like porcelain arms and feet and their face. I think they're the ones at the soft bodies. Do you know the ones I mean?
I think I might have had some of those. Because we definitely had China dolls when I was younger and they came with like stands.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that they could stand up.
It's just odd that like the certificate or label, the ones that say like genuine,
yeah,
Leonardo collection, that kind of thing, that was found there as well. And I think there was like a shopping bag, but they're not sure if that had anything to do with it. It's fair to say that at the time, Craigmillar wasn't a particularly affluent area of the city, and apparently right next to where he was found there was a lot of boarded up areas and, you know, burnt out flats and things like that. So I think what they were saying with some of the debris lying around, they weren't sure what was relevant and what wasn't, because yeah, it was just off a footpath as well.
Yeah.
So they're not entirely sure, but those are the things that have been raised as possibly being relevant. Locals were completely devastated at the discovery of the young boy, and the community came together to raise funds for a funeral and a memorial for the baby. They actually gave him the name Craigmillar, after the area which he was found and the area that mourned him.
Yeah.
A Guardian article shows the depth of emotion that was evoked in the locals. So I've got a quote. Richard Holloway, the former Bishop of Edinburgh, who chaired a commission, said he'd not been surprised by the overwhelming response to the boy's death. He said, "I think this demonstrates the fact that Craig Miller, in spite of his difficulties, is filled with warm-hearted people, many of them struggling in quite difficult circumstances. What strikes me about this response is it has focused on compassion rather than tabloid anger. That's very heartwarming." And then there was a lady called Janet McKay, who had lived close by her whole life. And she said, quote, "We just feel so strongly about this baby. He belongs to us. He will not be forgotten and he will not go into the ground without a name. We will give him a decent burial with a name and a headstone and there will always be a fresh flower." More than 400 people attended Craig's funeral.
Oh.
And a local funeral director donated a four-sided obelisk in memory of the child. The funeral, the flowers, everything was paid for by the locals, which, as we said before, it's not a particularly well-off neighbourhood, so people were just reaching into their pockets and giving whatever they could because they just felt so horrific.
Yeah.
About this wee guy. It's just awful. To this day, the parents of the baby have never been identified. However, the police do have his DNA on record and they routinely check it against their databases. There was a cold case crew 10 years after, so it was roughly, when would that be? 2011? Yeah, one of the articles, Detective Chief Inspector Bert Swanson. This wasn't the same detective that was on the case at the time, but this is the one that was looking after the cold case reviews. He said, quote, "We cannot say for sure how the baby died, but afterwards it was deliberately set on fire."
So he wasn't alive when he was burned?
They don't know. That's why I'm loath to say it's definitely a crime or a murder inquiry.
Right, because they don't know if he passed away from natural.
Exactly. However, I don't know what you would be charged with for setting a corpse on fire. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know what you'd be charged with for...
Yeah.
For abandoning or discarding human remains as well. So I don't know the legalities around it.
Sure.
So continuing the quote, quote, "What we do know is that the baby was bathed, clothed and bottle fed, which suggests that it was wanted, but it somehow only survived on this earth for a period of less than 24 hours. There is some discrepancies about how long they believe Craig was alive for, but this detective believes that it was less than a day. He continues, "There were also no records of his being born in a hospital or medical centre, so it looks as though it was a secret birth or a concealment. And the chances are more than one person knows about this, because it's highly unusual for a mum to give birth on her own, to feed, bathe, clothe, and then deposit and set fire to a baby, and then just return to normal life."
Yeah, absolutely.
"The evidence has been exhausted to a point, but we still have the DNA, half from the mum and half from the dad. We have been checking it against the National Crime Database to see if we can get a hit. People are coming onto that database every day." He said that obviously DNA link would be the most likely breakthrough, but he is still pleading with anyone with information to search their conscience and step forward first. He said if we get a hit, you know, DNA match in the database, then we would have to investigate that, but we would prefer people to come forward of their own free will. There's definitely a story here, and I suspect it will be a sad tale. Until we establish what happened, the case will remain open and we will make every effort to solve it once and for all. It would give us a great deal of satisfaction to close it." End quote.
So you said that was in January 2001?
Sorry, it was March. I do apologise. It was March 2001.
March 2001. So we're just coming up for 20 years now. Mm-hmm. So hopefully there'll be a fresh appeal.
Yeah.
If there hasn't been one already, there'll be one on the anniversary of when he was found or born in March of this year. And hopefully that milestone and appeal will, you know, rouse some people into coming forward. And
I do completely agree with him. It's so unlikely that only one person knows what happened.
Oh, definitely.
It sounds like maybe there has been, you know, an accident or something's happened. The only thing is, if there was any truth to the there being other injuries on the child's body, you have to worry a bit if maybe the mother was in an unsafe environment herself.
Yeah.
And something's happened to the child. I am very much with them in that if you're a mum and, you know, she's got the baby grow and the satin on the blanket and she's feeding the baby and it's clean. You do hear stories where young girls, for example, may just give birth and then abandon the baby because they panic and they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
But they're usually straight after the birth. It's not, oh, I've got...
I'm showing love. After. Yeah, exactly.
I'm caring for the child. I'm feeding it. I'm bathing it. So whatever it is obviously a horrific situation. Mm-hmm. Whatever's happened, I don't know, maybe someone thought they were getting rid of evidence. That's the only thing I can think of. Why would you do that? If they did hurt the child, was there DNA? I mean, they would have known about DNA at that point.
Yeah. I'm assuming, did they say anything about toxicology?
No
results.
There's no reason that they have come to that would show why the baby was
okay. So there was no evidence to say that he, you know, was born drug dependent or anything like that.
I believe they most likely would have come forward and said that because they've given all the information that they possibly could, and the fact that it's been hinted at heavily and secretively that there was injuries on the body of the baby as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what use it would be to them to hide that information.
Yeah, definitely.
Because if they can't prove that the baby was killed anyway, you know, if they can't prove that it was homicide, then I don't know.
Yeah, they just want to know what the circumstances were.
But I can understand why you'd be so scared to come forward if you knew, because you could theoretically get done for, I don't know,
whatever the crime is.
Yeah. In America, is it tampering with a corpse? I think it is in America, so whatever our version.
Yeah,
is.
I'm not sure what it would be on Scots law, but, you know, it's such a desperately sad case.
Mm.
But I think the thing that always is sort of the saving grace for me, and it was the same with the death of Mikhail Kular, is that the outpouring of love that comes from the community. Yeah. When something like this happens, the overwhelming emotion is love. And
it was like one of their own had been taken. And that dog walker actually was, he spearheaded a lot of the money raising campaigns.
Yeah.
And, you know, he spoke to all the different media outlets as well, but not to put himself forward or, you know, to show off or anything like that. It was just to raise awareness.
Absolutely. And I think that's definitely a saving grace for me. It's the fact that the community, you know, have come together, you know, they've accepted this child as one of their own, and they've, let's face it, we both know that, you know, Craigmillar is a poverty-stricken area. We know that. The fact that they've, you know, dug deep into their pockets in order to be able to give him a decent burial. And you
it's
know,
a beautiful funeral. You can actually see, there's a couple of pictures online, and his casket is white and it's beautiful, and they've obviously done everything that they can to make it as special and make whatever they can do to show him that he was loved.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the really sad story. Well, the kind of poignant story of Craigmillar, who, even if he wasn't loved as he should have been in life, most definitely is being remembered in death. So we
absolutely
have that to be grateful for. If anyone does have any information, obviously, as we always say, please do contact the police. If you're in the UK, you can call 101, which is the non-essential police number. And you can also contact Crime Stoppers, which is anonymous. So you can go on their website or you can call them. Both of these are anonymous. Their number is 0800 555 111. That's also in the UK, but obviously you can Google and get alternative numbers if you're outside of the UK. Joanna, now that once again I've thoroughly depressed everyone, do you have a true crime fact or story to cheer us up a bit?
I do enjoy the ones that are kind of like quirky laws, you know, old laws that have never been changed in years and things like that. But I'm taking a bit of a different tack this year. I do enjoy the ones that are just stupid, just funny, just ridiculous. They do always give me a chuckle. So, and this one is relevant because it was an attempted robbery in Scotland. Yeah, it was basically on the Isle of Rothesay. Robbing a bank isn't quite as easy as it might look in the movies. That said, the three men involved in the attempted Rothesay bank robbery of 1975 probably handled the situation in the absolute worst way possible. Upon first entering the bank, the unarmed trio managed to get stuck in the revolving doors after trying to push them the wrong way. At this point, it wasn't clear that they were robbers, and the bank staff kindly helped them out of the predicament. Shortly afterwards, though, they returned and demanded £5,000. Unfortunately for the robbers, they caught the staff at a bad time, who were still laughing amongst themselves about the revolving door incident. They thought that the robbers were just playing a practical joke and didn't take the demand seriously. Puzzlingly, the gang leader lowered the demand to £500, which was met with further laughter. To show he was serious, the leader jumped over the counter, but fell and twisted his ankle. In a panic, the others ran out of the revolving doors, only to get stuck again in the exact same way. I mean, that's like something out of a slapstick movie.
That is amazing.
I mean, just wow.
Like, if you've never managed to get stuck in a revolving door, have you lived? Because I get stuck in them almost every time I try and use them. And that includes workplaces where I've had to go in the same door every day and I've looked at it and it's almost like a face off. I'm like, right, are we going to do this again? We are, aren't we? We're going to do this again.
Yeah, I actually have a funny revolving door incident story for you. I was involved in it, but it wasn't me that was stuck in the door. I used to work for people that live in Edinburgh. They'll know that the head office of Standard Life is on Lothian Road, and that's where I used to work. I started working there as a school leaver when I was 16, and I worked there for 7 years. And whilst at Lothian Road, me and a guy I worked with were leaving the office one night, and it was well known that you basically go under the building in order to get in it. So there was like two sets of revolving doors on each side. What would happen is when you would come in with, you know, your friends after, like, you know, a cigarette break or lunch, whatever, they would press the seal that was outside the revolving door, which would basically stop the door revolving. And then after like a sort of few seconds pause, it would then move again. And everybody played this joke on each other. It was kind of a common thing. But I actually never had. I'd never done it to anybody. I had it done to me, but I'd never done it. So this guy who I worked with, who I was friends with, who had done it to me, you know, we were coming back in from, I think, a cigarette break or something. We were both working late. I think it was around 6 o'clock. And so most people had left for the evening. And I think the reception staff were actually off as well. They weren't at the front desk anymore. So he was going through and I was pressing the seal, you know, just sort of getting back, have a bit of a laugh. You know, we're working late, a bit tired. Well, anyway, it basically jammed and would not open.
No.
Yeah, so he was stuck inside it, right? Absolutely.
Properly stuck.
It wouldn't go.
Oh.
It wouldn't start back up again. So he was absolutely fuming. Stood inside the lift with a face like a melted welly.
How long did he get stuck for?
Well, the thing is, I had to go and ask for help, but I couldn't.
No.
Because I was laughing so hard that I couldn't actually go.
Oh,
because I was like doubled over, like literally holding my stomach, doubled over, like killing myself laughing, like stomach aching, tears, like kind of thing. And he was so angry. And me laughing obviously just made him angry.
Oh, no.
And he was like mouthing at me like, fucking go and get help, go and get help. Like, and that just made me laugh harder. So then I eventually went to go and get help, realised that the receptionist had gone for the night, and like still completely like laughing. I think I found a security guard and had to basically try and explain to him through like fits of laughter and gulping air that he was basically stuck in the doors. And I got him out and he was fuming. So
did he still speak to you?
Yeah, he did. He did, actually. And
it's probably terrified you.
But do you know what? Like, I'd never done it before. I'd had it played on me a bunch of times. It was just a silly joke, whatever. He was just a bad sport about it, frankly.
I love that I don't even need anyone to play prank on me to get stuck in one of those. I'd have been like, oh, not again.
But yeah, so it was the security guard that I had to find to get him out, basically. So he did, I think he was stuck in there for a good 10 minutes or so. Well, I went and found somebody that could help him out, but yeah, he was not amused, but
hilarious.
Whatever.
Thank you so much for listening. You've been listening to Murder, She Spoke. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to get in contact with us, you can find us on social media, Murder, She Spoke Podcast. All right, see you in a week. Bye.
Bye.